Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your moderator for today. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's special guests, Melody Hobson, financial commentator for ABC Television's Good Morning America and president of Ariel Investments, and Paul Schott Stevens, CEO of the Investment Company Institute. Let me tell you a little bit more about each. Melody is president of Ariel Investments, which is a Chicago-based money management firm. And as president, she is responsible for firm-wide management and strategic planning, overseeing all operations outside of research and portfolio management. She has become a nationally recognized voice on financial literacy and investor education. She is a regular financial contributor on Good Morning America and a frequent guest in ABC's World News Tonight. In 2009, she served as executive producer and host of an ABC primetime special, Unbroke, What You Need to Know About Money. Beyond her work in finance and investor education, she is actively involved with a variety of civic and professional institutions. Her community outreach includes serving as a board member of the Field Museum, the Chicago Public Education Fund, and the Sundance Institute. Additionally, she's on the Board of Governors of the Investment Company Institute, where Paul is. She's a director of DreamWorks Animation, Estee Lauder Companies, Groupon, and Starbucks. I don't know how you fit that all in with all your responsibilities. And Paul Schott Stevens has served as president and CEO of the Investment Company Institute since June of 2004. He is also a director of ICI Mutual Insurance. Previously, he was ICI's general counsel. And outside of ICI, his career included varied roles in private law practice as corporate counsel and government service. He was a leader of the financial services practice of Deckert and general counsel for mutual funds and international enterprise at Charles Schwab, where I was. Earlier in his career, Stephen served as special assistant for national security affairs to President Reagan, as executive secretary and legal advisor of the National Security Council, and in other senior positions at the White House and the Pentagon. His current community and civic activities include service on the Finance Council of the Catholic Diocese of Arlington and the Executive Board of the National Capital Area Council of the Boy Scouts of America. Now please welcome Melody Hobson and Paul Schott Stevens. And Melody, I believe you'll start first.
That's right. So thank you very much, Evelyn. It is a pleasure to be here today. And Paul and I love going out on the road together. And I was telling him earlier, I said, we need a nickname. Like, am I Robin and you're Batman? Or, you know, what can we be? But I'm delighted to be here. And what I'd like to do today is, one, I'd like to just give you a little bit of a background on my own story and my firm as a setup to a bigger issue, which I'd like to talk about as it relates to some nuanced interpretations of what's going on with saving and investing in this country, particularly as it relates to race in this country. So as means of background, my firm has been in business for 29 years. As you've already suggested, we were started in Chicago. My business partner started our firm when he was 24 years old. His name is John Rogers, and he had a very unusual story in that his father bought stocks for him every birthday and every Christmas, starting when he was 12 years old, instead of toys. He says in the beginning it was not very fun. He'd run to the tree, and the only thing he'd have was a white envelope. But the great thing was that his father allowed him to keep the dividend checks. And although it was a modest portfolio, he said when you're 12 years old, the two things that you don't ever get are, one, mail, and two, checks with your name on them. So it didn't matter if the checks were for 50 cents or $50. He loved this idea of getting free money in the mail. He loved also the idea that he could do whatever he wanted with this free money. And so he was a 12-year-old with cash flow. And he said that, you know, if he wanted to buy a candy bar, he bought a candy bar. But what he quickly started to realize was that if he reinvested those dividends, the investments grew, and he started to become obsessed with the stock market and investing. The reason I start with that story is because I always tell people that Ariel Investments is a childhood hobby that became an obsession, that became a company. And the reason that our story is even more nuanced than that is that when John started our company at 24 years old, he started the first minority-owned investment firm in the nation, which is hard to imagine. Nearly 30 years ago, we were the first, but we were. And that story is very relevant to some of the things that we've seen when it comes to saving and investing in this country by race. Now, I tell John's story first because we want that story for everyone. We want the story of understanding money regardless of race. We want the story of entrepreneurship, if that's what someone chooses to pursue, and this comfort around money, which interestingly came out of the fact that his father was a child of the Depression and grew up as an orphan and happened to be a Tuskegee Airman. So all of that led him to push his son to really understand money. So that's, in many ways to me, the American dream. Now, that's very different in some ways than my early beginnings. I'm the youngest of six children. And when I grew up, my mom was a single mother. And she very much tried very hard and worked extraordinarily hard for us. But there was no conversation in our home around the stock market, no conversation around investing, and there was really no conversations around savings because money was so tight and scarce. And so as a result of that, my understanding of the stock market and investing really started when I was an intern at Ariel between my sophomore and junior years at Princeton. And I knew nothing about it before that, except for it was a concept that I saw on TV in the news at the end of the day when they talked about how stock markets had done, but I had no idea what they were talking about. Well, it turns out my story is more relevant than not in terms of most Americans, because we don't grow up in America learning about the stock market and investing in school. And that has profound implications for us as individuals and profound implications for our society. The way I often think about it is we're handing the keys to our financial futures to all of us through the savings plans that we have at work. They are actually great plans, but no one gave us driver's ed. No one taught us, in many cases, how to use them, which puts a lot of burden on the company, and it puts a lot of burden on the individual. And so the thing that I've really honed in on is this idea that in America today, you can go to high school and then take an elective in wood shop or auto and not take a class on investing, which always leads me to ask people, who whittles in their spare time? Who's cleaning their own carburetor, right? And my role at Good Morning America, I've done some amazing pieces around the country, including standing on the street and asking people about their knowledge of investing as a way of teaching. And one of the things that I've learned from doing that work is our country has to develop the tools and the incentives that are needed to drive financial security in this country. We have those opportunities there through these great plans that we have in with our employers, but we just haven't adequately been taught how to use them and totally take advantage of them. Now, that's not to say people aren't winning with investing we're not making progress, but I think we can make even more progress with the right underpinnings. How I see it is that we have three legs of the stool to retirement. This is not a gee whiz statement that I'm making. Certainly, many companies have traditional pensions where you work for the company and you get some portion of your income paid out to you after you retire from the company. The problem right now is pensions are largely, not exclusively, but largely underfunded in our country, somewhere in the neighborhood to $2 to $3 billion. Now, with markets improving and getting stronger, that gap can narrow, and I'm confident that it will in the next decade or two. But at the same time, that puts more pressure on the system. Years ago, two-thirds of workers in corporate America were covered by a traditional pension. Today, about a third. Now, that still covers lots and lots of people, and it's still a system that is extraordinarily important, but it isn't what it once was, and I think many of us understand that. And also, there's always been somewhat of a fantasy about pensions versus reality. To hear it told, you'd look back years ago and think everyone in America had a pension. They didn't. And in many cases, many of us didn't often work at a company long enough to be able to take advantage of the pension that existed, just because of our society being much more mobile than it used to be. The other thing about pensions, which have allowed them to be more challenged in terms of new companies having pensions, is they're expensive plans. So traditional old school companies have trench pensions and modern companies don't. So if you look at Silicon Valley or if you look at San Francisco here, which is a hotbed of entrepreneurship and new companies, I can basically assure you Twitter does not have a pension. Right. You know, and so when you look at that, but they do have a 401k, which makes 401k plans extraordinarily important, probably more important than people who started them originally realized that they would be. The cost of pensions also can be prohibitive from some companies. When they're public, the hit to earnings that they have and how they have to pay out pension dollars and stay on top of it is something that can be challenging to companies as well. So pensions aren't what perhaps we ever thought they were, but also they aren't what they, you know, perhaps we would want them to be in this current world just because of the way companies are coming online. So the second leg of the stool is Social Security, and we all know the Social Security system is one of the great entitlement programs in this country. I have to say I'm a big believer in Social Security. It is a safety net for people who perhaps don't have the same opportunities, and it also enhances the income of millions and millions of people in retirement. And so I think our government has to work really hard to make sure we preserve Social Security in this country. Now, with that said, the average Social Security check in America is $1,100 a month. So for most people, even if it does end up replacing a significant part of their income, it's not a lot of money, and we have to acknowledge that. I don't think any of us think that living in our golden years is taking in under $15,000 a year as income. I don't call that golden. And even if you've been an individual who didn't make a lot of money, that's still a challenged way to live, no matter what. So beyond Social Security, 401k plans, originally intended to be supplemental income and have moved to being a very important lever in terms of retirement security in this country. I'd have to say that the onus on 401k plans is greater than it's ever been, and the onus on the individual participating in the 401k plan to be smart and disciplined about their savings is greater than it's ever been, but if done correctly, it can drive a fantastic outcome. So understanding those three stools and how those relative stools and relative legs of the stool have changed, I think is something that's very, very important. Now, the one thing that I would say, I told you that the lens that I look through is one of race and diversity. Being the first minority firm ever started, we started to ask ourselves some questions many years ago, back in 1998, about what does retirement security look like by race? We know that there weren't a lot of people in our field doing what we do. And we said, if you look at and hear all the statistics about the browning of America, what does that mean in terms of financial security? So if I've raised some issues around overall financial security in this country, I'm going to turn up the volume a little bit when I talk about race, because we've seen some things there that are extraordinarily significant. We were in partnership with Charles Schwab and Company back in the late 90s doing a attitudinal survey about investing between blacks and whites in America. The first year we did this pioneering study, there'd been lots of studies done on gender and money, but never on race. We asked a very simple question. Do you own stock or stock mutual funds? 57% of African Americans making $50,000 in income or more said they did, versus 81% of our white counterparts. We said, this is a significant gap that we never expected. And then when we looked at the actual amount of money that these individuals had saved or invested, African Americans had about half the account value of our white counterparts. Well, we found that this was a conversation and a subject matter that few people were talking about. Now, we found a major light in this tunnel, in that African Americans that were participating in their 401k plan were more likely to have investment accounts and savings account outside of that plan. So we learned very quickly that for minority investors, 401k plans were a gateway to saving and investing, which again made those plans very, very important. It's something that we said we need to focus on then what's happening inside the plans. So in 2007, we partnered with Hewitt Associates, one of the largest human resources consultants in the country, and we looked at 401k plan participation by race. The first year we did it, we had 57 Fortune 500 companies give us all of their data, and we got to look at the 401k plan data on 3 million people working in America. Just this year, we looked at all of that data again. We did the survey all over again, and this time we had 60 Fortune 500 companies, and again, about 3 million participants show us and tell us what they were doing in terms of their plans. So this time it wasn't attitudinal. This time we were looking at raw information. So the raw information was something that was very telling. We found out first and foremost that in 2007, African Americans and Hispanic investors overall or workers, we were participating at a much lower rate in our 401k plans than our white counterparts. In 2010, our numbers have gone up, but they're still much lower than our white counterparts. So 68% of African Americans and 66% of Hispanics are in their company 401k plan versus about 80% of whites and Asians. So those are big differences. When we do participate, we found that we save and contribute less as a community. So African Americans on average put away about 5.5% of their income into their 401k plan. Asians, 8.8%. Whites, 7.2%. And Hispanics are more like us at 6%. So we're saving less. And when we looked at that savings from 2007 till now, across the board, everyone has been saving less. Whites, Hispanics, Asian Americans, etc. The reason for that being we think there have been just a lot of stress on the system. As many of us know, families may or may not have the two incomes that they had before. That may be because someone lost a job. It may be because of pay cuts. And so as a result of that, our hard-earned dollars are having to do more. So we're not contributing as much as we did. When we looked at stock ownership, which over the long term is the way to compound money the best over time, notwithstanding the tough decade we had in the zeros, but the long-term data is inarguable that equity investments have been the best investments since 1926. We know that African Americans and Hispanic Americans tend to own less equity in equities than our white counterparts. And so that's something that also leads to big differences. So we're less likely to participate, we contribute less, and we tend to have less equity ownership. Now, we found some amazingly good things in our research as well, which is many plans in this country have moved towards automatic enrollment. You come and work at the company, you're automatically put in the 401k plan unless you consciously elect to opt out. Now, here's the great thing about that. Automatic enrollment has increased participation across the board for everyone. In many ways, it's equalized participation. So more or less, between 80 and 90% of people who work for companies that have auto enrollment are participating. That's a good thing. So when you think about the fact that I told you 68% of African Americans were participating in their plan, well, when there's auto enrollment, the number is 82%, which is great. When they're not subject to auto-enrollment, the numbers tend to look like the national averages that we've seen. Now, here's the double-edged sword. The good thing is that the rates of participation go up. The bad news is that we tend to default to whatever our company has done for us. They've told us we're putting away 1% of salary. That's all we ever do, and we don't increase it. So as a result of that, when you look at the actual amount people save, if they're auto-enrolled, African Americans and Hispanic tend to save less. So our actual savings rates are lower when we are auto-enrolled than when we, on our own volition, participate in a plan. And that was a nuance that we were not expecting. Now, we found something which I call the savings killers, and these are loans and early withdrawals. The numbers for minorities are staggering. So almost 9% of African Americans have taken an early withdrawal from their 401k plan versus 1.7% of whites. So an African American is 5 times more likely to have a loan or early withdrawal than our white counterparts. Interestingly, Hispanic Americans, 3% have a loan or early withdrawal. So the black numbers are very, very high in terms of withdrawals. Loans, 50% of African Americans had a loan. 50%. And we looked across income bands and we saw the African American numbers at every income level were higher. Now that's versus about 1/4 of whites and 40% of Hispanic Americans. Now just to let you know, there is something to having a culture of saving and investing. Only 22% of Asian Americans had a loan. So 50% of African Americans had a loan that they've taken out from their plan. Now, when we even cut the data even more finely, we said, let's just look at the median income. Let's look at that income band from $30,000 to $60,000. What's going on there with loans and early withdrawals? Because that's a vast part of our society. Well, 12% of African Americans had a loan, 12%, versus just under 3% of whites. So four times more African Americans had a loan. And interestingly, the Hispanic numbers were around 5%. So again, African Americans more than double our Hispanic counterparts, showing that we really need to think about these issues. So these things, when we looked at that as it related to loan, that was early withdrawals, almost 60% making $30,000 to $60,000 of African Americans had a loan, 60%, 6-0. So higher than that 50% number that I said generically when you looked across all income levels versus about a third of whites. So all of these stats we looked at together and we said, what's the bottom line? What does that account balance look like? How much do people have saved or invested? The African American account balance was 40% lower than our white counterpart. So the African American tended to have about $24,000 in their account, and that's looking across all income bands where we just took the average, versus the typical white American had $42,000 in their account. And just to give you the other comparables, white Americans and Asian Americans had about the same amount, 42,000. Hispanics had more than blacks at 27,000. So African Americans had the lowest account balance of all of the groups. So you might ask yourself, what can be done? At Ariel, we have a saying. We don't want to just admire the problem. I've given you a lot of data where I could spend, you know, I could spin yarns about this data forever without telling you solutions. So I'm not here to admire this problem. We think there are things that can actually be done. We've had, first and foremost, the effort of just shining a light on this issue, bringing attention to it so people understand this is not a black or Hispanic issue. This is everyone's problem to the extent we all have not saved or invested appropriately, because we'll be a burden on society. And that means higher tax dollars for all of us. So you may have done a super job saving and investing. And if your black coworker in the cube next to you hasn't, that may actually impact you one day, which is why we felt the need to draw attention to this. We also think that we have a responsibility to educate people, not just shine a light. So we started a school. We have an Ariel Community Academy that has a saving and investment curriculum, and we give every first grade class $20,000 to invest. And we want to see that replicated around the country where youngsters can have the John Rogers experience of understanding stocks at a very young age. And then last but not least, we feel the need to lobby for change. And we do that in three ways. We think, one, the government has a role. So the government should be creating and continuing to enhance a great defined contribution plan system and making sure those incentives that are there for all of us to participate, including the tax benefit, do not go away, because that is actually something that attracts individuals to investing. We think that if you take out a loan in your 401k plan and you change jobs, you should be able to take the loan with you. Because the way it works right now, you've got 60 days to pay that loan off, and if you don't pay it off, it's an early withdrawal, and it wipes out your savings. We think that's a bad idea. It should be, and if you lose your job, you should have a grace period. Just like when you go to college and you have student loans, and if you choose to go to business school, you can defer the loans. We want to see something happen in that way. So again, you're not constantly starting over and wiping out your savings. And that's significant, because if you are African American or Hispanic, in this great recession, we've been disproportionately affected in terms of layoffs. We have a higher unemployment rate than our white counterparts. So if 50% of us have a loan, we already see that money wiped away right as soon as we get laid off, which is significant. Lastly, we think the government should mandate financial literacy in schools. We think that we should let's stop the madness in that regard. In terms of corporate America, we think corporate should look at their plans by race, make sure they understand underneath the surface what's going on, so that they create the opportunity to speak to different investors in different ways and really to move the needle on making sure everyone is doing better in those plans. And last but not least, we continue to believe the individual must understand, which has been something that has been slow coming in America, the buck stops with them. because of just the psychological change that has occurred in the last 20 to 30 years around the importance of individual accountability on saving and investing, we have to really hammer this in that you're all you've got. And you've got to make sure that when you go and work for that company and you're 22 years old graduating from college, or you go to work for that company when you're 18 years old graduating from high school, that you understand the seriousness of putting that money away early and often so that you can have a secure retirement, because you just don't know what you can count on in the future. At the end of the day, I'm a big believer in 401k plans, defined contribution plans in this country. I want the government to make sure that they stay as good as they are. I want us to understand those racial and ethnic differences that occur and cultural differences. And last but not least, I want to make sure the individual is able to arm themselves with the knowledge and information they need to secure their retirement. Thank you.
Thank you, Melody. And now, Paul, I'll turn it to you.
How soon do you want to go to questions, Evelyn?
We've got, 10, 15 minutes. So
okay. All right.
Take it away.
Well, I want to echo Melody's sentiments and thank you, Evelyn, and thank the club for an opportunity to appear in this very distinguished forum and to talk about something that Melody and I both share a passionate interest in, and that's the ways in which Americans can make their retirement era a more secure one. Melody's illustrated, I think, really quite dramatically many of the challenges that the 401k system in particular faces, and no one would be right to diminish or to minimize any of those. I want to spend a minute, though, talking about the successes that the system has, because I think that's extraordinarily important, and it's important because we're all going to be increasingly dependent upon 401ks on individual retirement accounts and other DC-type savings plans as we try to build a secure retirement. First, despite the financial crisis, we as a country have accumulated $18.5 trillion in retirement assets as of the middle of 2012. ICI, among other things in our research program, sizes the U.S. retirement market on a quarterly basis. That $18.5 trillion represents more than a third of all the household financial assets that the country has. Second, I think it's also important to note that our private sector retirement system, and I'm including here both traditional pensions, which play an important role, as well as defined contribution plans, are providing more benefits to more people than they ever have before. Yes, you heard me correctly. More benefits to more people than ever. The conventional wisdom too often that you read about would maintain that there was once an era a golden age of the gold watch, if you will, where most Americans were covered by a traditional defined benefit pension, and that somehow or other, with the advent of the 401k world in the mid-70s, that private sector retirement benefits have declined, that we're worse off now than we were before. In fact, today, the share of retirees who receive retirement income from private sector plans has risen by almost half from 1975 to 2010. In 1975, about one person in five received a benefit from a private sector retirement plan. Now it's close to one person in three receives benefits. And the median benefit that those people receive has during that period of time risen by almost one-third after adjusting for inflation. Now, that's thanks to both improvements in defined benefit arrangements as well as the growth of 401k plans. Another thing that's underreported, I believe, and that Melody adverted to in her comments, is that 401ks actually can help people accumulate enough assets to replace a substantial portion of their income during their working life. Mm-hmm. Today's 40-year-olds are going to be the first cohort of American workers who will spend their full career in a 401k-based system. Studies that we've done, realistic modeling around things, as Melody has said, loans, withdrawals, that sort of thing, contribution rates, as well as the Employee Benefit Research Institute in Washington, have demonstrated that these workers can replace a substantial portion of their working income if they stick with it, if they use 401k plans on a continuing basis. And that research has been confirmed by economists like Jim Viterba at MIT, Steve Venti at Dartmouth, and David Wise at Harvard, all of whom have said that the rise of these personal account savings programs are going to increase wealth at retirement across all income levels. Now, why is this the case? I would single out three elements, and we really need to be conscious of these. First is portability, the second is ownership, and the third is innovation. You know, we're a really mobile workforce in the United States, and it's not unusual for people any longer to move from job to job, even from career to career. That puts a premium on having a retirement benefit that you can take with you, that is portable, that can travel with you through your lifetime. And portability reflects the second key, ownership. The holder of a 401k account actually owns the assets in the account, not just a promise of future benefits. Now, let's be frank, as Melody's comments underscore, owning and investing one's own assets entails some risks. And no one needs reminding that the average 401k balance during the financial crisis fell by more than a quarter. But the design of these plans limits the impact of investment shocks and it mitigates risks in important ways. Remember, workers are saving and investing paycheck by paycheck by paycheck in accounts that tend across the board to be diversified. Beginning in 2008, in the teeth of the financial crisis, we started surveying record keepers of 401k plans to understand how participants, broadly speaking, had behaved, how they'd reacted. We weren't doing the more microscopic or granular work that Melody's described with looking at investors, 401k participants, by race or ethnicity. But if you talk about it across the board, we found a remarkable commitment to stay the course. Even in the depths of the bear market, fewer than 4% of savers quit contributing, and fewer than 1 in 7 switched their asset allocations. As a result, despite the downturn in the market, these savers were poised to catch the upswing when stock markets recovered. In fact, with market gains and new contributions, 401k assets actually have risen 49% since 2008. And the third factor is innovation. You know, we talk about these innovations like auto-enrollment, auto-escalation, target date funds are another important one. These are innovative funds that allocate savings between stocks and bonds based on workers' retirement horizons, and they rebalance those as markets move and as a participant ages. These and other kinds of innovations have been very important to the success of the system. But is the 401k system perfect? Of course not. And there are lots of ways it can and should be improved. Melody hit on one of them that's very important, particularly now. We need to preserve the tax incentives that are associated with retirement savings that enable workers to save for their retirement more effectively. We need to improve and to expand DC plans for workers and retirees in many of the ways that Melanie had indicated, and we need to increase access to retirement savings opportunities for small businesses and individuals. I'm going to cut this short because I really want to get to your questions. But what one important thing is to note, if you think about retirement security in the United States, and Melody had the traditional three-legged stool analysis. Actually, stools are tippy in my experience. I think of it a little bit differently, more like a pyramid. At the base of the pyramid is Social Security, and it's imperative that we maintain Social Security, the social contract around it, for future generations, and that's going to take some work in Washington. The second part of it you can actually think of as home ownership, because home ownership, equity interest in a home, can be an annuity over time. The third is going to be employer-sponsored plans. It may be a DB plan, it may be a 401k plan, it may be an individual retirement account, and the last part is individual savings. You need to make all parts of that pyramid work if you really want to get to the apex, which is a secure retirement. So, Evelyn, let me stop there, and we can go to questions.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. So the first question I have for Melody, the employers have moved into the automatic enrollment plan, but do you find that some are still having reservations about adopting those automatic enrollment plans, and what are those reservations?
Sure. I mean, it's not universal yet, okay. So 100% of the companies don't do it. You've seen the large employers move down that path. I think some of the reservations is people have had concerns about what kind of liability they're taking on when they do it, although all of the congressional documents and views on this suggest that the employer is safe in this regard. I think there's a sense that some employers feel that it's a very paternalistic move in that they are mandating participation even though the individual can opt out, so they feel like they're overstepping in their role. And I think some just haven't gotten to it yet, and I think they will. Paul might have an opinion on it.
Well, you know, I think Melody's hit on many important aspects of this. You can auto-enroll new employees, but then that leaves existing employees who didn't get into the plan sort of stranded. A better approach to encourage employers would be to go to the baseline and auto-enroll everyone. Yeah. The question then is what level you're auto-enrolling them. When the government came out with its auto-enrollment authority, it used illustrations of enrolling people at 3% of their income. 3% looked like a safe number, but it wasn't intended to be a mandate. It was an illustration. And so employers ought to think beyond the 3%, because 3% is probably not going to be enough. Right. And then there's auto-escalation, which is an important thing, too. Once you're in the plan, you can get an increased amount contributed to your 401k, and we need to encourage employers to think of those terms in those terms as well. Part of it is a liability concern. Part of it is a lack of clarity. I think everyone agrees who's looked at this that we need to continue to encourage employers to move in that direction.
But nobody has been sued yet. I mean, the whole liability question raises worries about lawsuits, right? But nobody has
been sued.
There's
a safe harbor,
safe harbor,
under the Department of Labor regulations, and this was anticipated in one of the most important pieces of legislation, the Pension Protection Act of 2006. It was a landmark piece of legislation that encouraged these kinds of innovations.
The one other thing I would just add as a nuance is we did do an attitudinal survey with 19,000 employees of different companies, and interestingly, auto-enrollment is very much celebrated yes. by the employees, and particularly minorities, because they feel like the company is forcing them to do the right thing.
That's great. That's great.
And part of that, too, Evelyn, is a default investment option, because some people, while they may be in the plan, they kind of freeze, what should I be investing in? Target date funds have been particularly powerful as a device in that regard, as a way of helping people to rebalance over time and to make sure they have a mix of both equity as well as fixed income securities in their investments.
And that's a good suggestion. We'll talk about investments in a minute, because I know target date funds received a lot of criticism in 2008 when the stock market went down. The criticism was both for excessive fees and because as you neared closer to your target date of retirement, you still stayed heavily in equities rather than moving towards bonds. But my belief is you have another 30 years to live, most likely, beyond your age of retirement. And for women, we probably have another 40 years to live. So you wouldn't want to be all in bonds. So could you comment on the target date funds some more?
Yeah, I think there was a failure to frame expectations appropriately around some of the target date funds, where the target date was close to where the market hit its bottom. And people were surprised at the extent of the hit that their account took. Remember, what a target date fund is trying to do is to make sure that you don't react to those kinds of market events by pulling back when you ought to be invested in equities and therefore running the risks that you're not going to have that appreciation over the longer term. What you heard about the problem of target date, particularly 2010 target date funds in 2008, but what people haven't heard as much is that even as Washington was debating all of this stuff, those same funds the next year increased in by about 31% at the highest, a quarter or so on average. And so the people who are in those funds benefited from precisely the kind of discipline that they were intended to offer. Still, there are regulations out there, more disclosure, better ways of framing people's expectation, which we support and both the DOL and SEC are considering.
Great. Thank you. And Melody, you had a great suggestion around modifying the loan rules and withdrawals. What is the general response that you've received for those kind of suggestions?
I think we're getting traction on this one. I think the mutual fund industry sees the benefits of doing it because the great thing for them is to the extent the loan becomes portable and goes to the new employer, more assets are paid into the fund, which is great for them. They're managing more money. I think this is one of just a logistical question of getting all the systems to work in such a way that makes it possible. It's legal to do, and so it's just a function of making it. There hasn't been a lot of energy around it until we've really started to put it to question.
So it's the employer that makes the changes around the requirements and covenants. There's no bank involved necessarily, correct?
No, there's not.
Okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about the role. You mentioned this before, the role of schools in educating. And I'll also ask a question about the role of the employer in educating the employees. But could you talk a little bit more about your investment that you mentioned that you do in Chicago, where you give $20,000, real dollars, to kids how young?
We start at first grade, give them $20,000 real dollars when they're in first grade. Our school is called the Ariel Community Academy.
Is it per kid? Or?
No, have a class gift.
I'd like that.
We actually spent a lot of time thinking about, our school was started by Arne Duncan, who's now, of course, the Secretary of Labor. He worked at the Secretary of Education, excuse me. He worked at Ariel for quite a while. He worked at our firm for 8 years. And we'd had this dream about financial literacy in schools, and he'd been very much tied to the educational movement in Chicago. And we did toy with the idea of individual accounts, but the problem was the mobility in the Chicago public school system was such that once the account was in the child's name, the parent could liquidate it. And if the child moved, we said it really doesn't accomplish the goal that we want. What we do, however, is we turn over the portfolio to the children in portions, starting in sixth grade. They take over a portion, seventh grade, another portion, in eighth grade, they have the whole thing. When they graduate, they give $20,000 back to the incoming first grade class to make the program self-perpetuating, and Schwab has been an important partner with us along the way as well, in that what we do is the remaining profits that are left over, the students divide. They have to first give half to a philanthropic gift to their community. 80% of our kids are on free or subsidized lunch, so we largely have a disadvantaged community. The other half of the profits they get to split. And for every child that will put their money into a 529 plan for college, we match it another $1,000.
Wow.
And so the idea there is that they become acclimated to the idea that you never walk away from the free money. And so we want to make sure that when they're in that 401k plan, they're at least contributing enough to get the free money. The great thing is that investing becomes like sports for the kids. We open up the day with the opening bell of the Dow and talk to them, and we have a closing bell as well. And they really are fully aware of what the markets mean, how it works with the Dow, the Nasdaq, and the S&P are. They understand individual companies. They follow individual companies. And so it's been extraordinarily exciting to see this take so easily, and Paul has been to the school to see it.
I sat in on a discussion to the seventh grade investment committee, pointedly talking about the future of Yahoo. It was really quite remarkable. But we need to multiply this so broadly, and it really, I think there's no alternative really in our society than building it into our core curricula at an early point in the schools, and also doing what we can to educate adults who are facing these problems and who are beyond their schooling years to assist them.
The great thing about the school is that the parents have to deal with homework that they don't know anything about. So it, in a backhanded way, gets the parent more aware of the stock market investing, and that ultimately affects decisions that they make in terms of their own defined contribution plan investments. It also has affected the teachers who are teaching subject matter that maybe they had not had experience before. The question that we ask, and being provocative, imagine if we had a financially literate society. The housing crisis wouldn't have turned out the same way. Imagine if we had a financially literate Congress. I mean, these are things that
now you're
make
now
huge
you're heading
difference.
Into the political aspects of it.
And I don't say that so to be true. Disrespectful, but again, if you don't have that in schools in America, it does affect the outcome. Mm-hmm. And we put people in charge that maybe do not live with the stock market and the investment world the way we do on a daily basis, and yet they legislate around it.
Very good. Paul, did you want to add anything more?
I'm not going to touch the Congress.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests are ABC News financial commentator Melody Hobson and CEO of the Investment Company Institute, Paul Schott Stevens, who are discussing investing and the future of retirement. Let's turn it for a minute to the employer. I see Carrie Schwab in the audience here, and she's on a task force that was started in President Bush's reign. Now it's with Obama, on financial capability framework for how employers should play a role in helping to educate the employees that they have. So what role do you think employers should have?
Well, I think it's an important one, and it's sort of built into the system to some degree. You know, one of the complaints about 401k investing is that people are on their own. There is certainly more individual responsibility, but you start with an employer who selects investment options that are available to the employees in the plan. I think, by and large, employers are very conscientious in that. They're looking for the right mix. They're looking for low cost. They're looking for good performance and good managers and providers. And so it's within that framework, then, that their educational mission has to be pursued. So you're already sort of, you have one leg up already. I must say, companies in our industry, so many of them devote enormous resources to assisting employee populations to understanding their investments. But there's no end of work to be done there,
right?
Because there are so many workplaces in which it needs to be done.
I also think that while the employer is the first line in terms of that education that can occur, government must make it easy for them to do their job and for the mutual fund companies to be able to, that serve those plans, to be able to do their job. So what do I mean by that? We've had, and it's very much inside of our industry, inside the Beltway, discussions about what the employee needs to know. And it amazes me that I find that we are often in the weeds, splitting hairs on things that ultimately don't drive the decision of that bus driver sitting at their kitchen table with their wife who's a school teacher making an investment decision. They're not asking about nuances of 401k plans. They're still at 30,000 feet on aggressive versus moderate versus conservative, not what's a 12b1 fee, what is, you know, this, that, or the other. And so, you know, I've often told people that in my work at Good Morning America over many years, I don't ever get those questions. I don't ever get the questions that are being debated at in some of the Washington conversations around what investors need to know. I get the questions about what's a good fund, how do I know it's a good fund,
right?
How do I pick a fund, how do I understand how to put these funds together, or explain the target date option to me, things like that. And I think that our government needs to make sure that we don't over manage this process so that we lose the forest through the weeds. And I said that, not Paul.
Yeah.
No, I think Melody's right. And one of the things that we fight against all the time are regulatory proposals that will have unintended adverse consequences,
right.
Freezing the process by which helpful information reaches employees, burdening it with too many potential legal liabilities and pitfalls, which are a real disincentive for employers. So we have to strike the right balance
right.
here.
And I am not anti-regulatory in my tone. I don't want to come across that way. I just want to, it's like the example that I've given people when I've been in Washington, it's like the security question you get at the airport. Who says no, the bag wasn't with me, right? No one. And so there are certain things that are given as disclosure on this thin tissue paper that is in the smallest font that ends up cluttering the message of what the person really needs to know. So then the person just says, I don't even have time to read any of this. And we've seen it with mortgages, credit cards, and now I think it occurs with 401k plans, which ultimately obfuscates the most important information that the person needs to know.
Right. There's too much information out there.
You know, we as an industry...
It's not too much. It's just, is it the right information?
Right. We as an industry fought long and hard to get authority from the SEC to boil down prospectuses to what was the key information people needed. Not to deny them a rich array of information
right.
that could go beyond that, but to focus them in a summary that was accessible. We need to do more of that. And frankly, I believe we also need to rely more and more on the kinds of tools of information accessing that people in our society are using. That means more electronic media.
Yes.
And we need to find a way of using social media reliably for these purposes as well, because those are the communications mechanisms that younger Americans who need to start into this game of saving are utilizing.
Not to mention the jargon.
Yes.
So it's called 401k because that's the IRS tax code
right.
that it is tied to. You know, we could really simplify a lot of this. You know, none of this is intuitive. But if you called it your, you know, individual retirement plan at work, you know, it probably is more likely for that Hispanic worker, that, you know, African American worker to take to it, not to mention the white worker as well, but where we've seen some barriers just around the language.
I had a visitor from overseas who came to me at the Institute once and wanted to find out more about our 401 OK system. And I thought that might be a good name.
You add the OK to Social Security and then you're OK, right? That's how it works. So could you talk about the individual itself? I mean, we've been talking at this high level, but I think a lot of people want to know, so how much do I need to save to be able to survive in retirement? And what's the average savings for a 50-year-old? You mentioned it, I think, a little bit, Melody, with the average balance in a 401K, but that's people save beyond that. So the average savings is, what, $50,000, $60,000?
We're not saving enough. I mean, that's the bottom line. So we did a survey in 2010 where we looked at retirees already out of, you know, the workforce, and we asked them how much money they had before they retired. Now, the interesting fact was that we found about a third of the people had over $100,000 saved. 20% of the people had basically between somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $100,000. And yet almost 50% of the people had under $25,000 saved for retirement. 50% of retirees. Now, of course, that's not cut by what income they had when they retired and things like that. But even if you were at the very lowest end of the income spectrum, $25,000 saved for the next 20, potentially 30, maybe 40 years is a challenging situation. So from an individual perspective, again, while I believe the individual has the tools to do better, I think we have to really think about a mindset shift in our country around the importance of saving and investing, and we've really got to step it up. But the old rules don't apply. So there used to be a rules that said, well, you need a portion of what you made in your peak earnings years because your house will be paid off. Well, I tell people you need to replace 100% of your income. The worst thing that can happen is you outlive your money. And I say 100% because whereas we don't necessarily have the same commitment that we need to make to the home in those years, we do have that commitment in terms of health care. And so it's offsetting in terms of the savings that you used to get. And as a result of that, these numbers are bigger than we think. Now, with all of that said, I'm always cautious about how I discuss this, because then people say, well, like, forget it. You know, why even bother? It's like when you hear people have a baby and they do those statistics of Princeton's going to cost $3 million a year when this child is 18. Well, then the parent just throws up their hands and says, why even bother? And we've been able to show you do want to bother, because even the smallest amounts make a difference over time.
We need to become a nation that recovers its thriftiness.
Yes.
That's where I think Melody and I absolutely agree. And that's a message we ought to be giving our children and our children's children in very, very stark terms. I'm not quite as doomy and gloomy about our future, though, as Melody. And there's one reason in particular that I would say why. For those Americans who are least able to accumulate financial assets towards their retirement, over the years, Social Security has become an increasingly progressive safety net. And I think in order to maintain its viability going forward, that progressivity is likely to be enlarged, so that for those in the lower earning groups, Social Security, and it's inflation adjusted, so it's a terrific annuity, is something that will be there replacing a very substantial portion of their pre-retirement earnings throughout their lifetime.
And that, you know, I want to make sure that, you know, I underscore I'm an eternal optimist. I am the glass half full person, and in the worst of times, I always see how things can be better. My point of view is not doom and gloom. My point of view is a sense of urgency. And I think there's a difference. I think with a sense of urgency, anything's possible and people will be in very good shape. But without that sense of urgency, that's where I get very concerned. And I can lean on real life experiences to shape my point of view. So I mentioned at the very beginning of the conversation that I'm the youngest of six kids. Well, I'm really young in my family. My oldest sister is 25 years older than me, and we have the same mother. So I'm really young. I have a mother who's in her 80s, who was an entrepreneur and very rarely paid into Social Security based upon the fact she had a catch-as-catch-can existence. And so her Social Security check every month is $400.
Wow.
Total. She never was in a 401k plan. She didn't work for a company that had a pension. And if I did not have the benefit of having gone to a good school where I ultimately ended up with a good income, I don't know where she'd be or what she'd be doing. No, that is a worst case scenario. It's the scenario that none of us wants to think about. But that's my mother. You know, that's someone that I can look to and point to and see she worked hard and tried to do all the right things, but she could never live on $400.
Right.
So that's what gives me this sense of urgency that wants me to go out literally screaming at the top of my lungs, tell people to understand, take this seriously now, put your head down, get that thrifty mentality that I think is so important, and make sure you are putting yourself first when it comes to those years later in life, because your choices diminish dramatically in old age.
And that I think
I stand corrected about the doom and gloom.
Yes.
I would say urgency, absolutely. And you can do it.
You can do it. So what, Melody and Paul, what do you recommend that parents do for their children to encourage it? I mean, if we can ever get this done through the school system and we can get it done through the employers, but what do parents do? What tools do you, would you recommend they do to arm their kids?
You know, my mom, and we all have family stories, but my mother always taught the value of a dollar. And one of the things that I tell my children is, if you see a penny on the sidewalk, pick it up, because your grandparents would be ashamed of you if you didn't. And you remember there's this famous 60 Minutes story when Andy Rooney was there in the sidewalks in New York, and he put change on the street. I think he determined that it had to be something in the order of 75 cents before anyone thought it was enough to actually lean over and pick up. It's that sense about valuing a dollar and understanding that a dollar put away today for a long period of time really does have a powerful multiplier in terms of your future
security. Well, you know, some people believe in giving allowances to their kids but tying it to chores. So could you comment on that?
So I have a few ideas about this. And the one thing, if you give the child an allowance and you tie it to chores, you run the risk of the child going on strike.
Right.
I mean, they can just decide, I'm not working this week, and so therefore I'm not getting my 75 cents. You can choose to have a household that's like that. I mean, I've seen that before. Or you can say, you know, this is separate and distinct, and these are responsibilities you just have in the house for living here. But there are a number of things I think parents can do, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this because I think we can move the needle with kids easier than we can move it with anyone. First and foremost, one of the things about our cashless society is that our kids do not see us use bills. And so as a result of that, there's this sense that money is endless, even in the most hard-pressed families. They think you go to a machine and money comes out.
That's right.
And, or you will often hear kids say this. We've all been in a grocery store where a mom says, we can't afford it, and they say, put it on a credit card, because they don't think that they're the same things. So understanding that they are taking all these financial cues from you and tying out that machine to work is extraordinarily important, so that the six-year-old starts to understand it's just not this magical place where you go and get money, which is very different than when we all grew up.
Yeah.
Secondly, my mom did something that I thought was genius, and I really encourage it. When I was a child, she always had me pay the bill at the restaurant. So when I was a little kid, it was just literally walking up to the counter and having the courage to do that. As I got older, it was the ability to count the change and make sure it was right. As I got older still, it was the ability to compute a tip. And all of that was obviously wonderful for math skills, but more importantly, I knew what things cost. I knew that McDonald's was cheaper than a restaurant with a tablecloth. And yet, many kids today don't understand actually what things cost. If you ask the typical teen, what does your cell phone cost? They have no idea. None. So I think these things should be introduced and understood by teens at an early age. I think parents should give their teen a credit card. This is making me crazy, and people think I'm nuts for saying this. We give kids driver's ed. They have a driving permit for a year before they can actually drive a 3,000-pound vehicle. We hand them a credit card when they're walking out the door.
For college.
And we haven't taught them anything about how to use it. Now, of course, we're tied to them because we have to co-sign for them when they get those credit cards. But we haven't walked them, given them the training wheels along the way, and walked them through it. And that's something that I think is very important. Last but not least, I love the idea that if you're going to have your teen work during the summer, you have them put a portion of that money into an IRA when they're like 15 years old. And start getting them used to the idea, I'm saving for my retirement at 16, mowing the lawn, delivering the newspaper, babysitting. And so then when you talk about them graduating from high school or college and not thinking retirement is far off, it's just they've been socialized to know they have to save for the day when they can't work.
Could I have just, in my role for the ICI,
sure,
add one more thing? You know, you can make an investment in a mutual fund at remarkably small dollar amounts.
Yes.
And I think the idea of that and perhaps a savings account at a bank are two very good things. I certainly did that for my sons, and those statements are opened as soon as they arrive. And they've gotten a sense that investments can go up and they can go down, and they have a sense of the market. They also have a sense that this is something that's set aside for a long time.
It's the John Rogers story.
Right.
You know,
right.
They love McDonald's, buy McDonald's. They love PlayStation by Sony. They love
Starbucks.
Their iPod by Apple.
Starbucks.
So right? Maybe the 5-year-old isn't going to Starbucks. But
well, they are with their moms to buy the
hot
chocolate.
Hot chocolate.
Right. I know, that's the big one. Are there any retirement plans or other suggestions you have for non-working individuals?
Non-working individuals. If you have some income, I think the individual retirement account is something that is a very powerful tool. People don't use it, unfortunately. They roll over 401k balances into a rollover IRA. But the IRA is something that's available with tax advantages for virtually everyone. And I would certainly think that could be a useful tool.
Great, thank you. And Paul, you mentioned defined benefit plans, defined contribution plans. What do you think is the future for defined benefit plans?
Well, the trajectory, I think, is very clear. There are a substantial number of people who are collecting benefits from those plans, but there are far fewer of those plans being started. Many of them are being terminated in some fashion. Mm. And it's because of the very significant challenge of knowing how to fund today an obligation that will be dated 30 years hence. It's a problem even for state and local governments in terms of public employees. I think it likely indicates that the defined contribution type arrangement, you see this actually internationally, is going to be the direction for the future. And therefore, we all have to put our best thinking together about how to make those really powerful tools for retirement savings.
Right, right. I think it's hugely underfunded today, which is causing the headache for a lot of people. And then we do have a lot of questions around investments. What's the right investment inside a 401k plan? And Paul, you and I talked a little bit about exchange-traded funds. Are they the right investment tool inside of a 401k?
You know, ETFs are yet another wonderful innovation in the industry. They allow you to trade in and out of essentially an open-end fund like you would a stock. There are some structural aspects, though, that have made them not as easy to put into a 401k format. They have tax efficiencies in a taxable account, but the 401k is already a pretty tax-efficient vehicle. And there's been a challenge systems-wise about the money that they throw off, getting it reinvested in order for the account to accumulate. Over time, these are likely to be overcome. But goodness, the reality is that if an ETF is what you have in front of you to invest in, the point is, do it. Use whatever the tools are that you have. I think they certainly have the characteristics that all mutual funds do in terms of diversification of risk, as long as they're a broad-based index that they're investing in.
Great. Thank you. Well, we have time for one more question. So I'd like to ask both of you, what would you like us as the audience to do to help you achieve the suggestions you've been talking about?
Mine is very simple. If you have a child, a grandchild, a niece or nephew, a godchild, demand financial literacy in their school immediately. That's number one. Number two, if you are working and saving for your retirement, max out at work. Contribute as much as you possibly can, and at the very minimum, at least contribute enough to get the company match. Lastly, if you have the ability to influence those that you don't think are saving and investing appropriately for their retirement, not in terms of what fund they're picking or things like that. Perhaps they don't understand the sense of urgency that I've talked about. Tell them what you've learned today so that we can hopefully start a movement that will continue to have individuals feel very secure as they age. So those are my takeaways of how individuals in the audience can move from also admiring the problem to doing something that affects action.
I would just add one thing. We're going to be entering a huge debate in Washington about tax policy. And when we survey Americans about the 401k system, overwhelming numbers, 80% and more, say they think these are tools that they have a great deal of confidence in, will help them save for their retirement. They really value the control over the accounts, and they also value the tax incentives. So if you agree with all of that, urge that the tax incentives for retirement savings, on which we all depend, be preserved through this debate. Everything's going to be put on the table, but in the 401k world, it's not a deduction or an exclusion. And this is very important. It's not like a home mortgage deduction or an exclusion of employer health care costs. It's a deferral. So it's not as though in the 401k system you're getting away with something. What you're doing is you're getting away with growth in an account, and then when you withdraw it at retirement, you will pay taxes.
Right.
That's the mechanism that I think we all ought to urge Washington to preserve.
Right, wonderful. Our thanks to Melody Hobson, financial commentator for ABC Television's Good Morning America and president of Ariel Investments, and Paul Schott Stevens, CEO of the Investment Company Institute. We also want to thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, and now this is a meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. The place where you're in the know is adjourned.
Thank you so much.